given by Danny Schechter sums it up nicely. As McChesney is to linguistics, Ben and Jerry's to ice cream, and Elvis to shaking one's hips, McChesney is to media analysis. He is the king. There is no one more definitive. So please give a warm welcome to Bob McChesney.
Thanks a lot for that very generous introduction, Steve. I should say I don't do linguistics. That was Chomsky is the linguistics. So I'll leave that one to Noam. But thank you very much, and thank you all for coming. I know that you've got a lot of things you can do with your time, and coming out to hear some professor talk isn't always at the top of someone's list after a hard day at work or a hard day at school. I'd like to thank Judy Broadhead for being so generous and bringing me here and showing me around and taking good care of me today. And I especially want to thank Steve for bringing me here and really being the motor force behind this. I'm very privileged at this stage of my career. I get a lot of opportunities to speak at college campuses and invitations, and I pretty much only accept one or two a year at this point. And because for family reasons, and because I have to travel, unfortunately, or fortunately, I guess, because of my activist work outside of giving talks. And the reason I accepted this one was primarily because of Steve. In fact, the only reason was because of Steve. When we started the group Free Press a year ago, when we started taking memberships for people who wanted to support the group, Steve was our very first person who signed up. And I have a very long memory, and I'm very loyal to my friends, and he established himself as a very good friend at that moment. Are we not? Okay, is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's why I'm here, to show my appreciation of Steve's commitment before anyone even knew about our group, and it was just sort of an idea and a matchbook cover, and he voted with his feet. Now, I usually, when I come to give these talks, am the bearer of bad news. I mean, for years, they bring me in to give talks to get everyone really upset with how terrible things are. I sort of like, God, I didn't realize it was that bad. And I have people leave my talks and go, damn, man, why did you have to tell me that? I was having a pretty good life until now. Now you tell me how this media system works, it's hopeless. I was always the bearer of bad news. And I think now, unfortunately, I'm someone who can come with some good news. And I can periodically weigh in, and I think I can weigh in tonight especially, and say that as bad as things are, they can get better, and they will get better. But it's going to take some political organization to do it. It's going to take some hard work. But I do think now that we are poised to be at the verge of a moment politically where in our lifetimes or sooner, we can make dramatic change for the better in our society. But to understand the sort of changes we have to make, and that I think we will make, we have to understand the severity of the crisis we're in today. And make no mistake about it, we are in a very deep and profound crisis in our society today. The media are greatly implicated in it. They aren't solely responsible. They play a very large role in the problems we face. And it's a crisis, really, that I think can be summed up as the collapse of viable, accountable self-government in any meaningful sense in this country. The sheer, utter, undeniable deterioration of anything remotely close to a democratic system of governance, combined with what comes with that, which is a degree of corruption now in our governing system across the board that is simply rarely precedented in this country's history. Perhaps in the Gilded Age we might find antecedents that would grasp the degree to which corruption now, the rule of plutocracy, of big money, without popular and informed popular consent, is ingrained across the board in our governing system. That's the crisis we face, and it's very much a media problem. Not exclusively, but very much a media problem. Media are implicated in reinforcing the problems we have and preventing our ability to solve these problems in a humane, peaceful, and democratic manner. To give some sense of the crisis we face with the media, let's take two of the issues where a press system, a media, are foundational in a free society. Two areas where you can really test the viability of your press system. Consider, first of all, the decision to go to war. What more profound decision can any society make than to go to war, to kill people, to devote resources, enormous resources, to conquer people or to get conquered, to fight people? The most serious decision any society can make. In a free society, in a democratic society, the role of the media, of a free press, is to give the people in the society the information and capacity to make an informed decision about whether to go to war. In fact, there's what more, if you can't do that, what good is it? That is a good measure of our society. Now, consider the fact that in the last year we've invaded and now we're occupying Iraq, and consider how the press coverage was leading up to that invasion, and how what sort of job it did in giving the people of this country, giving you and me, the ability to weigh in as informed citizens and participate in that decision to go to this war. And before we even talk about that, consider the historical legacy of press coverage of invasions in United States history, going back, say, 100 years. In the last 100 years, the United States has invaded other countries or fought overseas, I don't know the exact figure, roughly 80 times. Most of those are quickie carpet bombings no one even knows about. You just go in and, or go to Grenada and knock off a government or something. But there have been, you know, 6 or 7 major invasions, major wars with ground troops that have taken a sustained period of time, required popular support for them to be engaged in. World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the first Gulf War, now the current Iraq War. And what we know in each of those cases, if we look historically, in every single one of those cases, the president in office in the White House wanted to go to war, but was convinced the American people did not want to go to war. And the president was given sort of a moral dilemma. Do I try to convince the people in the just cause that I believe we should fight this war? Or do I lie to them to get their support? Because I know if I tell them the truth, they won't support it. That was the dilemma. Woodrow Wilson faced it in 1916, and he failed it. He ran for re-election as the candidate who kept us out of war, while he knew he was going to put us in war as soon as he got through the election. Because he knew that people wouldn't vote for him if he said he was for war. Lyndon Johnson did the same thing in 1964. World War II, Roosevelt did the same thing too. The great line about Franklin Roosevelt wasn't that he led us into war, he lied us into war. Whether we agree with it or not, he did. Because he didn't trust the American people to support a war, so he lied to us. Korea, the same. So here we, journalists know this, this is our legacy. The press basically has had presidents lie, and we know in most all those cases as well, the media went along with the president. The media did not present a critical enough perspective in the lies that were told. And the people, in most cases, not in all of them, but in most cases, were not well served by the press system. And in some of those cases, most notably World War I and Vietnam, were wars that had the people known the truth, had the wars not gone into, I think we'd all be much happier today. These were wars that were basically senseless slaughters of life and unacceptable. And the media's failure to do a good job of keeping liars in line led to much human misery and disaster. I suspect there are families in this room who are paying for it to this day. So that's the legacy journalists face when another president comes along with another bag of tricks telling us time for a war we have to support. And that's exactly the way to understand how journalists should face it. It's at that moment journalists should be at their most skeptical, at their most resolute, at their most demanding to see evidence, hard evidence, before we're going to get people killed or kill other people. And what did we see? I regret to say, and I take no pleasure in this, that the media performance in covering the build-up to that war was absolutely deplorable. I mean, this grade could only be an F, and that's with a curve. It was simply, I mean, consider the major claims for this war, which we now they're almost punchlines of jokes. They're so preposterous. But a year ago, if to say these things, to challenge these things, would get you hooted down on half of our television programs. The idea that Saddam Hussein somehow was connected to the Al-Qaeda terror network, and this had something to do with the war on terrorism, now something laughable. The idea that Saddam Hussein and the Iraqis had weapons of mass destruction, which were an imminent threat to the people of the United States, that was the legal defense given for why we could violate international law and invade them, an imminent threat of weapons of mass destruction. Again, a claim that was absurd then, and now we know it was just a blatant lie with no evidence. And there was conscious knowledge that there was no evidence for this in the U.S. government. Now, one of the striking things for many of us, including myself, and I suspect many in this room, thanks to the internet, you could read European press, Canadian press, the press in any other nation in the world, where these claims of President Bush were not treated like the claims of a maximum leader who could not be challenged, but were taken at face value and then examined. And so if one, like myself, my wife's Norwegian, so I have a chance, she reads the European press widely, these claims were dismissed as nonsense in most parts of the world, or at least taken very skeptically. But in our press system, they were accepted really almost as revealed truth. We were being spoon-fed the presidential line. Well, we see the results. We see a war now that's an unmitigated disaster. And it's a failure not just of a lying president and of a lying administration, but it's a failure of a press system that didn't hold it accountable when it could have done that, when it should have done that, when a free press needs to do that. And we're left with the absurd situation that speaks volumes about the problems of our journalism. At the New York Times about a year ago, almost a year ago exactly, one of their reporters, a gentleman named Jason Blair, was run out of the profession. Jason Blair's crimes were fibbing on stories, making up sources, lying about quotes. Jason Blair was on the cover of Newsweek magazine. He had forced out of the New York Times in disgrace. They ran an unprecedented apology. The top two editors of the New York Times resigned their position since they were complicit in Jason Blair having his job. At the same time, the exact same time that Jason Blair was run out of the New York Times for his doctoring stories, making up quotes, and inventing largely trivial matters, another reporter at the New York Times named Judith Miller was running numerous stories asserting that the Iraq did indeed possess weapons of mass destruction on unnamed sources, oftentimes plants from the government that were being given to her, ran with tremendous authority in the New York Times. These stories have been entirely discredited completely by the New York Times' own reporters since then. But they were instrumental, foundational in sort of mobilizing support for this legitimate war. Judith Miller was never fired. Judith Miller still works for the New York Times. Judith Miller will probably be writing again. She might win a Pulitzer Prize sometime down the road. Jason Blair will not. But I'll tell you this. When Judith Miller and Jason Blair both meet their maker, Judith Miller is going to have a lot more blood on her hands than Jason Blair. But it speaks volumes about the type of journalism we have that I can say that Judith Miller has not been run out of this profession. And consider, too, now we're hearing news stories about the war. Keep your skepticism up. Now suddenly the defense of this war is that it's about democracy or freeing women. I mean, it's like there's sort of a grab bag reason for the war. Everyone that fails, they grab another one out of the bag and throw it up there. These should treat these with the same skepticism one treats should have treated those first two. Even if our media isn't skeptical, we need to remain skeptical. Consider one other area where media coverage is so foundational to a free society, the coverage of elections. Our journalism in the society is deeply troubled for largely commercial reasons. We don't have much left of journalism, certainly not investigative journalism, civic journalism, hard coverage of our public life. But the one way that journalism can compensate for all its limitations is if it does an effective job of helping people make good decisions, wise decisions on elections, help them participate in voting. And this is a real test of your journalism. If it really, even more than war, if it flops on helping us have viable elections and a viable electoral system, it really doesn't matter what else it does. If it can't help us effectively select our leaders and get rid of leaders who don't meet our needs, if it doesn't help us participate as citizens in the governance of our society. And here we see the crisis of our democracy in full bloom, the problems we face in this country. Today in the United States, we have a voter participation rate that's appallingly low, far lower than almost any other major country in the world, of any other developed country in the world. Voting in the United States more than any other country in the world is class-based. In the United States, less than half the population votes, even in the heavily voted upon elections. In 2000, for example, over half the voters came from the richest 20% of the population. Voting is significantly class-based in this country. Poor people basically tend not to vote. The working class tends not to vote. It's a real problem for a free society when you've got your voting concentrated in a relatively small percentage of the population. It's not simply that we see the problems. Very few of our races are contested anymore in the United States. Gerrymandering has basically destroyed electoral democracy for so many of our races. Out of the 435 House seats that are going to be up for contest this year, as every 2 years, probably as many as 380 are basically before the first candidate announces, we know the winner, maybe even 400. I mean, they're gone. I mean, the joke that Michael Moore likes to tell really holds true. There's more turnover in the Politburo under Stalin than there is in the House of Representatives in the United States because of the way they've rigged the elections. It's a damning commentary on the caliber of our electoral system. And that's not the worst of it. Consider the role of money in our electoral system. In the United States, the candidate who gets the most money wins the overwhelming majority of the time. It's cost a fortune to run for office. And my God, if we didn't have gerrymandering, the cost would be much higher, because in gerrymandered races, you don't have to spend anything. But the amount of money spent in federal elections in this country increases basically 40 or 50% every 4 years. The amount that will be spent on the congressional and presidential race this year will approach $3 billion. Where does this money come from? Where does the money for our races come from? Well, 96% of Americans give no money to any candidates. So it comes from 4% of Americans. And about 80 or 85% of all the money that goes from individuals to candidates for public office, for Congress, will come from individuals who rank in the top 1% of income recipients in the United States. 85% of the money. That's sort of interesting for a democracy. And what we know is whoever raises the most money usually wins the race. In the case of presidential races, for example, the candidate running for president in the party out of power, so this year would be the Democrats, John Kerry. 4 years ago, it would have been the Republicans and George W. Bush. 4 years before that, Bob Dole. The candidates running for president in the party out of power, whoever raises the most money the year before the election has gotten the nomination every year since 1976. Basically, before any of us get a chance to vote, once that 2% casts their vote with their contributions, that determines the winner. Then we get to go in and ratify their decision. That's in effect how our democracy works in this country. In this environment, it makes a lot of sense that people would tune out politics. It's not irrational to be depoliticized. Ultimately, it is. Ultimately, it's the worst possible thing. But it's an immediate response to this situation. It makes perfect sense you tune it out and be cynical and corrupt. And then where does this money go to that all these candidates are raising, these $3 million? Well, a majority of it goes to TV ads. Basically, it goes to big media companies to run insulting, idiotic, and deplorable ads, at best based on half-truths, almost always irrelevant. And also pouring flames or gasoline on the flames of cynicism among the general population. And I must say, as an aside, this year in the state of Illinois, we aren't going to see a lot of TV ads for the presidential race, probably, because I think in all likelihood Kerry's going to win this state. They aren't going to see many TV ads in New York. They aren't going to see many in California. They aren't going to see any in Mississippi. They won't see any in Texas. But there are about five states in this country, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, Missouri, Florida, that are going to have 24/7 TV ads in their local television stations between now and November. You're going to have the Karl Rove $300 million mud machine dump on every television station. And the Democrats will return fire. It's not a one-way fight, believe me. It's going to be a vast fortune that's going to go to the TV station owners in these five states with ads mostly telling you how the enemies, you know, the opponent's the worst thing that ever happened, the combination of a pedophile and a lunatic. And even the positive ads are even worse, you know, with these things kissing their dogs and playing football and strumming a guitar. I'd rather have a negative ad than those positive ones. At least they're entertaining. But they're all absurd. But they're insulting. They're ridiculous. And they're a measure of the bankruptcy of our political culture. And the serious, severe problems we have having anything remotely close to a viable electoral democracy. And what's the role of the media? Well, in campaign finance, the role of the media is self-evident. Our largest media corporations are to campaign finance reform, but the National Rifle Association is to gun control. They're the number one beneficiaries of all these TV ads. They get all this money. 12% of the revenue of our commercial television stations now comes from TV political ads. It was only 2% 12 years ago. This is a cash cow for them. They're the number one opponent of anything that's going to cut down on the ability of big money to buy elections, because the money, most of it ends up in their wallets eventually. So we see right there they're not our friends at all. And then the question is, but our journalism, our free press, how do they respond to this situation? Do they reinforce it or do they challenge it? Well, what could they do to counteract the problems of their political culture, our electoral system? Well, they could give greater emphasis to those candidates who don't have any money. So it's okay, the candidates who don't get any money get more stories, so they have a chance to compete. That would be one thing to do. Do they do that? Of course not. In fact, what our news media do, almost without exception, is the candidates who get the most money are taken seriously. That's a sign of whether you take someone seriously, how much money you raise. So if you haven't raised money, even though it's 3 months before any of the elections have been held, you're out of luck. You're clearly not a serious candidate. If the 4% of Americans who vote in the wealth primary haven't voted for you, the other 96% aren't going to get a shot to hear about you in the news media. That's what our news media have done. They could, of course, also give heavy coverage of the issues that aren't being talked about in political ads. Not let the candidates pick what issues they want to talk about. Don't let the candidate who's got $300 million to blow on TV ads run a big series of campaigns attacking the other candidate, have all the news about those stories. Ignore those stories. Cover other stories that might actually matter that they don't want to talk about. It could be a progressive, proactive force to challenge the rule of big money and the unfairness of our electoral system. Instead, it does just the opposite. Having money equals credibility. The people buying ads can basically define what the issues are going to be talked about in the news and how they're covered. And much of our news coverage is simply coverage of how politicians spin the story back and forth. I mean, that's what journalism, political journalism has become. Well, they spin it this way, they spin it this way, you go figure it out. It's a really wonderful situation to be a scoundrel, because you can get away with anything and no one ever challenges you. Because when you're challenged by your opponents, you dismiss it as partisanship, and there are very few journalists there to say you're lying and really push ahead on it. Pretty bleak picture. So I'm holding up to my name so far, right, that I'm the bearer of bad news. It's real, but it's dark, and the problems are serious, and they're heavily rooted in the media, and we've got to change them. So that's why I start there. And then let me give you one last bit of really gross out, terrible stuff that's happening in the world that's related to our media, and then we'll proceed to the good part of the talk. Hyper-commercialism. One of the overwhelming features of our media system today in our society is what I call hyper-commercialism, or the commercial tidal wave. And in the new book, which Steve graciously hyped for me, I have a whole chapter on this phenomenon. And this is sort of a long-term phenomenon that's part of our media culture, the collapse of the separation between editorial on one side and advertising on the other, creative and advertising, and sort of the disintegration of the barrier between them. So their entire media system now is simply every nanosecond, every square inch is all about selling something. It's all commercialized. Commercial values permeating everything and undermining whatever integrity there is to the content otherwise. As I said, it's a long-term phenomenon built into a commercial media system, but it's become completely out of hand in the last few years, and it's only getting worse. And what it says for our public life, what it implies is that the purpose of communication is basically to sell by any means necessary. All communication is about is trying to take advantage of people to get something out of them. I mean, notions like the truth, honesty, are quaint, but they're nonsensical in this environment where everything is about making a buck off someone else, every aspect of your media culture. It's in this environment, for example, that vulgarity blossoms. It's no accident that vulgar content in media is closely related to hyper-commercialism, closely related to media concentration. And isn't it ironic that the two companies that specialize in the most vulgar fare in media, Rupert Murdoch's Fox News Channel, Viacom's MTV, are the channels run by politicians very closely linked with George W. Bush and so-called conservative media like the Fox News Channel. It's an interesting connection. The hyper-commercialism manifests itself most grotesquely in our society, most evidently in what we're doing to children. Today in the United States, we're subjecting children to a commercial marination that is absolutely unprecedented in human history. Those of you who are 20, 18, 20, 21, college age now, you were in a non-commercial Garden of Eden compared to what two-year-olds are going through in this country today. Or when I grew up and there were three channels or four channels, I mean, it was a completely different world, I mean, by comparison. Today's children are getting the object of advertisers and marketers from the earliest possible age. By the time a child goes to kindergarten in the United States today, they know up to 200 corporate logos. They've learned 200 corporate logos as a result of the intense education the marketing community of the world has given to our children. Now, the range of debate for what we're doing to children in this society with commercialism and advertising extends from some people at one extreme position who say, well, this is probably a pretty bad thing. It's probably not a really good thing what we're doing to kids, bombarding them with ads from age one and a half, hours and hours a day. That's the one extreme position. The other extreme position, which is the position of all the teachers, child psychologists, pediatricians, is what we're doing to children today is absolutely outrageous and obscene. It's going to be total disaster in terms of obesity, attention deficit disorder, in terms of just the morality we're conveying to kids that everything's about shopping till you drop. That's the range of debate. Notice it's all on the side that it's bad. There's no one saying, hey, this is great. This is really great what we're doing to kids. What a great world we're going to live in 20 years from now after these kids get this great commercial indoctrination. And it's funny, I read an interview with the woman who ran Nickelodeon a few years ago, the Viacom Kids Channel, which is like probably the most profitable medium in this country because you make a fortune bombarding kids with ads. And someone asked her, I don't know how this journalist got in the room, do you let your kids watch your own channel? And she said, well, maybe an hour a day. they know. It's like smoking cigarettes. Well, of course, in Europe and in other countries of the world, increasingly there's a movement not to permit advertising to children under 8 on television or under 12. That's an irrational, humane way to deal with this issue. And provide non-commercial, educational, or entertaining programming to children, not bathed in advertising and marketing. And that's, of course, the direction we need to go. But that, I'm getting ahead of myself now. So why do we have these problems? Hyper-commercialism, dreadful journalism. Are they mistakes? Are they problems? Well, actually, these aren't errors. This is exactly how the system should work. This is the logical output of the system. Because our media, it's not that we have bad journalists. In fact, I think our journalists today, in terms of training and ethics, are as good as any or better than any, probably vastly superior. It's not that we have bad owners. I mean, we might have some bad owners, but even if Rupert Murdoch were to abandon his ownership of News Corporation, load up a bong full of dope and move to the mountains, and have nothing to do with News Corporation again, his company would probably still operate the same way, for better or for worse, because the owner of it would be following the same cues. Journalists, no matter who they are, are going to be following the same cues. The problem we have is that our media system is set up to serve the commercial needs of a very small number of huge corporations. And it does that very well. It's a smash hit. It's a success. The system works. If you understand that's what the system's all about. The problem is that what works for those corporations produces disastrous effects for a free press, for free people, in terms of journalism, in terms of our culture. That's the problem we face. Then the logical question is, well, how do we come up with this goofball system then? How do we get a system of media that's set up to make a handful of very large companies very rich, doing whatever they can to make money, regardless of the implications for our democracy, for our journalism, for our self-government, for our children, for our culture? How do we get this screwball system? Where does this system come from? And this is where the news gets, I wouldn't say good yet. Now we're leaving hell and we're moving into sort of purgatory now, on our way heading to other environs, because our system isn't natural. There's nothing that mandates that we have a system like this. Believe it or not, we didn't have a media system like this in 1789. And it might shock you that children in 1789 were not getting 20,000 ads a year. You know, Tom Jefferson III wasn't being marinated in ads. Believe it or not. This system is the result of nothing natural. It's the result of explicit policies. Our entire system is built on policies and subsidies. It's not a free market system. This isn't like the widget industry. We have 1,000 heroic entrepreneurs competing, making the best widget at the lowest price, and the best company wins, and the least efficient companies go out of business. That has nothing to do with how our media system works. Not a thing at all. Our media system is built entirely on policies and government-granted and enforced monopoly subsidies to corporations. What are these policies? Well, look at the 10 or 20, take the 20 largest media companies in the United States. Between them, these 20 companies own almost all our newspapers, most our magazines, all the TV networks, all the cable channels, all the cable systems, all the film studios, all the music companies, 20 companies, basically. And look at what they all are. They're all based on some form of government-granted and enforced monopoly privilege. The gift of radio and TV licenses for free. Monopoly channels. You give a company a monopoly channel to, you're the only one who can use this frequency for television in Chicago or New York or Springfield or wherever. Radio, the same thing. That's a spectacular gift of what we now call corporate welfare. That's a huge gift to these companies. I mean, Barry Diller, the founder of the Fox TV network, one of our most successful media entrepreneurs, has put it well. He says, the only way you can lose money in broadcasting in this country once you get these government monopoly licenses is if someone who works for you is stealing from you. Because once the government isn't just setting the terms of competition. When it gives these licenses, it's picking the winners of competition. You can't lose money if you get these broadcast licenses. It's impossible. So companies that get these, and all those networks have them, ABC, NBC, CBS, they're all owned by much larger conglomerates now. Disney, General Electric, Viacom, News Corporation, which owns Fox, all of them get this gift of government monopoly licenses they build their empires on. Another form of crucial government monopoly license is the gift of these cable franchises. Every community, you know, you don't have eight cable companies to pick from, do you? No, you got one. And guess where they came from? They got a monopoly license from their municipality that they're the one cable company you get to do business with. You don't like your cable? That's it. They get it. You get that monopoly. It's hard to lose money if you get a monopoly granted to you by the government, enforced by the government. Well, why do you think Time Warner built up its empire with all those cable stations? It's the top cable company in the country. And it used its control of the cable system to launch all those cable stations they own. They own all those cable stations. CNN, they came from the Turner system, but TBS, TNT, on and on. Then satellite. Well, that's your alternative. Well, guess what? How many satellite systems do we have in this country? We have two, because there's only enough spectrum space to have two satellite systems in this whole country. So we've got a duopoly of satellite systems. And we've got one cable company in every community. Those are all government-granted monopoly privileges. So this is nothing free market here. Once you get those licenses for those monopoly rights, it's hard to lose money. And then third, and most important, and oftentimes overlooked, the most important form of government enforced monopoly privilege is what's called copyright. The value of copyright is almost impossible to know because they don't keep track of it in corporate accounting, but the evidence suggests it's worth the tens, hundreds of billions of dollars to these corporations. So what copyright is a government-created enforced monopoly privilege for a content provider, so no one else can use their content. And initially, in the Constitution and in the first Congress, when the first copyright law was passed, the idea was to give an author enough protection so they'd monopoly rights to control their book, so they'd make enough money on it so they'd have incentive to write another book. That was the theory, and I think everyone accepts that's a legitimate use of copyright. That's the balance. You let someone have monopoly rights long enough so they can make money on it, so they have incentive to write more books. But once they have that incentive, it goes in the public domain. Anyone can publish it. The cost comes down, and it's part of the public domain. It's part of our common cultural heritage. That's the whole idea. Well, today, copyrights simply become permanent trade legislation to protect corporate media interests. Nothing's gone into the public domain now in something like 75 years because they extend copyright. So now, you know what a copyright was when the Constitution was drafted? For the first 100 years of this republic, even after it was extended, copyright was for 28 years. If you wrote a book, the author had copyright protection for 28 years. After that, it went into the public domain. Do you know what copyright is now for an author? It's life of the author plus 70 years. So by the theory is that if someone told me that when I wrote Problem of the Media, if they said, Bob, I got bad news for you, copyright's been cut back. Now it's only your lifetime plus 68 years. That I would say, oh, well, I'm not writing that book. Not enough in it for me. I'm not writing any more books then if I only get 68 years after I die. It's been taken over. It's been hijacked by the people who own the copyrights, the large media corporations. And it's become protective legislation. The government protects their monopoly privileges, and it's extraordinarily lucrative. Now, policies are not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, they're unavoidable. Every society has to have policies to create a media system. No media system happens naturally. Even a free market media system, to the extent you wanted one, if that was your goal, I want a completely free market system, would require aggressive and extensive policies to create a free market. It doesn't happen naturally. It's simply unavoidable. The problem in the United States that we face today, and the reason, the basis for our bad policies, which lead to our bad system, which leads to bad content, is that our media policies are made in the most corrupt manner imaginable. It'd be difficult to exaggerate just how corruptly they're made. In fact, I think it's fair to say that 99% of Americans have no idea these policies are ever made, but they're made in their name and without their informed consent. The gift of monopoly licenses to radio and TV channels, ownership rules, cable and satellite franchises, copyright extensions, which are done in Congress with no public awareness, although they have tremendous effect on the public. The way I like to liken to explain how media policymaking, communication policies are made by our government in this country is to hark to a movie called The Godfather 2, which is now 30 years old. If you haven't, has anyone seen that film? Raise your hand if you've seen it. Okay, if you haven't seen the film, I'd urge you to watch it because I assign it now to all my students. It's mandatory viewing to understand how power works in this society. There's a scene in the film about halfway through where all the American gangsters are in Havana, and it's 1958. It's before Castro's come in. It's Batista's running Cuba. And Hyman Roth and Michael Corleone and all the gangsters are on a patio, and it's Hyman Roth's 67th birthday, and they're dividing up Hyman Roth's birthday cake. And Hyman Roth's giving a slice of the cake to each of the American gangsters. And the cake has on it the outline of Cuba. And as Hyman Roth gives a slice to each American gangster, he's like, hey, Louie from Chicago, okay, you run that casino. Frankie from Pittsburgh, you and your family handle the prostitutes. You know, Joey, you get the drugs. They're dividing up Cuba among them. And while Hyman Roth's doing this, he's saying, isn't it great to be in a country with a government that respects private enterprise? And that basically is how media policies are done in this country. You have extraordinarily powerful lobbies behind closed doors dividing up a cake, much like those gangsters did in the patio in Cuba, all the time praising private enterprise, their good fortune to basically have a government lets them plunder the country like that. And understand, though, it's not a conspiracy in the sense that they all agree on everything. Just like if you remember The Godfather 2, the plot of the movie was Hyman Roth's fight with Michael Corleone over who got the biggest slice. So it is with those communication lobbyists and media firms in Washington and trade associations. They're all fighting to get the largest slice of the cake. I mean, the reason why they have massive lobbying arsenals, hundreds of lobbyists on Capitol Hill, huge campaign expenditures, isn't because they're scared of me or us, because they're scared of each other. They're fighting each other for the biggest slice of that cake. So they're all fighting like the Dickens for the biggest slice of the cake, but the one thing they all agree on, it's their cake, no one else gets a slice. They're the only ones who get in on the slice action. And that's the problem we face in this country, that we've got to end that corruption. My argument is we have to basically popularize our media policy and banking debates, bring widespread and form popular participation, and if we do that, invariably we'll have better policies that will lead to a better system. In fact, I would argue that it'd be unthinkable to have the sort of policies we currently have in this country if there is any modicum of informed public participation. In fact, it's clear that the media companies know that well because they do everything in their power to prevent any public awareness or participation in these debates, and they have for a long time. To give an example of one sort of media policy that would clearly not survive any sort of public inspection, consider the state of radio in the United States today. For a long time in the United States, a single firm was only allowed to own 7 radio stations total. That's the number of stations you were allowed to own in the whole country, 7. 7. Then it went up after a while to 12. Then 20, then 40 finally by the 1990s, 40 out of the 11,000 commercial stations in the country. In 1996, a couple of paragraphs were inserted into a law, the Telecommunications Act, that got no discussion at the committee level, no discussion on the floor of the Senate or the House, never mentioned in the news media whatsoever, that basically lifted the ownership cap in radio. It said a single company can own as many radio stations as it wants in the whole country. And it could own up to 8 stations in any single community, up to 8 stations in a single community, and as many as it wants in the country. Well, this sailed right through. Most members of Congress who voted for the bill didn't even know it was in there. In fact, I've talked to members of Congress. It was written by the NAB. They actually wrote the paragraphs that are in the law. And I've talked to a member of Congress who was on the committee that this law came through, the House Commerce Committee, and he didn't even know it was in there. And he was on the committee that was responsible for drafting this legislation. And I'm not picking, he's a good member of Congress, but I just want to give you a sense of how these things happened there, how removed our own leaders were from this. These guys, they didn't have to buy them off. They were so out of touch. Not to mention the news media didn't cover it. It was covered in the trade press. It was a story of interest to owners in the media industry, but not as a story of interest to the general public. Well, what has happened to radio as a result of changing those ownership rules? What is the result for this country? Well, it's been stark. Within 3 years of that passage in 1996, roughly 2/3 of American radio stations were sold, all from small companies to medium to large to massive. We now have a handful of giant companies like Clear Channel Radio, which owns 1,300 stations, and several others that own in the hundreds. Basically, the small independent station owner is gone. It can't compete in this market. If you only own 1 or 2 stations, you can't compete with someone who owns 8 stations in your community. They basically sell out. That's what's happened. They've all gone down. As a result of this, minority ownership of radio stations has fallen over in half, because minority owners tend to own the single stations. They couldn't compete with the big giants. What we've seen increasingly, too, is the complete elimination of local coverage in the news. Local radio news, local coverage whatsoever. I mean, if you own 8 stations in a market, do you need 8 news directors covering the news? 8 newsrooms? Of course not. 1 newsroom will do the job just fine. Then you think about, do you even need 1? You know, well, get rid of it all. Who cares? The Clear Channel model today, in fact, it owns 8 stations in a community. Like, if you go into a Clear Channel office and they build it now, they own 8 stations in the community, and they pipe in robot disc jockeys from their Texas headquarters, and their playlists all come from Texas. Their model now is you walk into their office, you open it up, and there's this office there with all the business people in the middle selling ads, and there are 4 closets in each side for each of their 8 stations. Each of them gets a closet. And one engineer can go funnel, push the disc in at each of the 8, the country station, the urban contemporary station, the Rush Limbaugh station, and just sort of plug in the disc. But that's what localism. Understand the tragedy of this. Radio, which is by far our least expensive medium, much cheaper than newspapers, internet websites, anything. I mean, what we know about radio is for a few $100 you can put on a great signal that cover half of Chicago. It's ideally suited, because of its cost, to lots of local control, local coverage, local context. It doesn't cost a lot of money to do. Thanks to that one policy change, it's become one of our most regimented, centralized, uncreative, unimaginative media. It's become a commercial sewer. Advertising, which was 11 or 12 minutes an hour in 1990, is now 17 or 18 minutes an hour on radio. And the balance of the hour is chock full of program product placements and all sorts of other infomercial type commercial activities. It's so bad that even people who are strong proponents of commercial media, like Michael Pollan, the head of the SEC, acknowledge that radio has been not gone very well since 1996. It is impossible to defend. John McCain, the Republican chair of the Senate Commerce Committee, says that the one thing every person in this country agrees on, in his opinion, is that there's too much concentration in radio. It's undeniable. Well, that couldn't have happened, and that would never happen if the American people had any say on this. No, that could, you'd never have that sort of policy. We'd have a policy of ownership that would be much closer to what it was for decades, 7 stations per owner, 12 stations. We'd have policies to encourage local owners of stations. And if we did, the prices would come plummeting down. They'd be much more accessible. Our radio system would have more local content, less advertising. Bad policies, corrupt policies, bad content. There's a clear relationship there. Radio is Exhibit A. Now, I think if we had increased public participation in media debates, clearly, in my view, what we'd find is we'd end up with policies that would encourage more competitive markets, much more local ownership. I think we'd also have a much stronger and diverse nonprofit, non-commercial media sector. I think one of the interesting things that's happened in the last year, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, is that this is not just a liberal, conservative, left-right issue. It certainly has elements of that. There's no mistake about it. When you're attacking corporate power or the power of big business, in our political culture, the left lines up on one side and the right oftentimes lines up on the other side. But what we've discovered in the last year, year and a half, is that there's a huge section of people who consider themselves conservatives in this country who are deeply concerned about our media system. It's deeply concerned about this media system. William Safire, the conservative columnist in the New York Times, about whom I think I can safely say, I've been reading him for 15 years, I've never agreed with a single word he's ever written. I can honestly say that. Wrote 8 columns in 2003 basically arguing that breaking up, having democratic media debates, breaking up big media companies, having decentralized competitive markets was a conservative issue. Conservatives should be leading this fight. He was the number one opponent of President Bush and Michael Pollan when he tried to have the FCC loosen the media ownership rules last year to allow the handful of big companies to get that much bigger. He understood that genuine conservatives, principled conservatives, a term that an entity we don't see much of today, we're in favor of small, accountable power, decentralized power, not concentrated power, be it public or private. And Safire makes a powerful case. But, you know, the fight to change our media, to bring popular involvement in these debates and this whole range of issues I've been talking about is not going to be an easy one. For one thing, as I've already mentioned, like that rooftop in Havana, this is an extraordinarily powerful lobby we're dealing with, one of the most powerful in Washington. Now, there are a lot of powerful lobbies there, so I don't want to say that they're the most powerful, but they're on anyone's short list, these lobbies. They're extraordinarily strong. In addition, they also have one advantage that no other group has, no other commercial lobby, corporate lobby, any lobby at all has, which is they control the news media. Don't think Philip Morris would have liked to have been in control how the tobacco debate took place by owning all the news? Sure, they'd have liked that. Well, the commercial news media control how any debates over media policy get covered, so how the general public is going to have access to understanding them. It's a tremendous bit of power for these companies, and they've exploited it ruthlessly for a century to prevent any informed public participation. So the degree of difficulty is pretty high from the get-go. And traditionally, most people have been very despondent about our ability to change the media system for that reason. They're saying, God, it's hopeless, man. These guys have all the power. They control the news media. They control the politicians. It's hopeless. Let's go on to something else. This is if we change everything else in the world, the media will come along last. We'll drag that one in at the very end. Once we've gotten rid of world hunger and got world peace and take care of all poverty and the environment, then we're going to drag in the media at the last, you know, drag it up aboard at the last second. That was the way people envisioned how we'd change it. And to even make it worse, there are several crucial myths that protect corporate media power and the corruption of our policymaking process. And any effort to change the media has to directly deal with and really repudiate these myths. And I just want to quickly run through them before I go any further, because if you can't answer these or deal with these, in my opinion, from my experience dealing with people for the last 20 years, you just simply can't have any hope of winning or convincing people in the importance of this fight. The first great myth is that our media system, our corporate media system that we have today, whether we like it or not, with all its problems, well, it's the American way. This is what the founders intended. The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. And whether you like it or not, that means basically rich people get to make as much money as they want doing media. If you like it or lump it, that's the American way. Congress will make no law. First Amendment's all about people having the right to make as much money doing free press stuff as they want. So that's just the way it is. Tough luck. Next issue. Let's move on. Well, there's a problem with that argument. It's complete baloney. It is absolute nonsense. And one of the things I do in this book is I went back and I tried to study the founding debates on media system in this country, Jefferson and Madison, the constitutional debates over what does freedom of the press mean. And then more importantly, the debates in Congress about free press issues in the first 50, 60 years of the Republic's history. And what I discovered and what other scholars have come up with now, it's a burgeoning area. In fact, there's a new book out by Paul Starr called The Creation of the Media, which deals with this. What I discovered is that, in fact, the notion that freedom of the press means just letting rich people make as much money as possible and letting the chips fall where they may simply is nonsensical. It's untenable. It has nothing to do whatsoever with the vision of freedom of the press of the first 100 years, and certainly the founders in the Republic. If you look at Jefferson and Madison, for example, the two founders who wrote the most about freedom of the press, who took it most seriously, who had the most correspondence and dealt with it most seriously, what you see is a clear understanding, which is actually reflected in our Supreme Court decisions, that the founders meant that the freedom of the press means that the government has a responsibility to make sure there is a free press for viable self-government. It's a commitment of the state to the people. And in fact, if you look at the early republic, this government put into place a series of major subsidies to create a free press. Major subsidies. There was no sense that we'll just let rich people do whatever they want and let the chips fall where they may and hope we get a free press out of it. No one thought in those terms. That sort of rhetoric didn't even show up for 100 years. To give some sense of the subsidies I'm talking about, start with printing subsidies. The founders didn't have the U.S. government printing office. And what the government did in the first 50, 75 years of the Republic till the Civil War is it farmed out all its printing jobs to printers. And the printers were connected to political parties, and they used the profits from those printing contracts to subsidize partisan newspapers. The National Intelligencer, which is the equivalent of the New York Times or the Washington Post in the first 50 years of the country's history, was a subsidized newspaper. Probably couldn't have existed left to purely commercial purposes. It needed those printing contracts. That's not even half of it. Far more striking are postal subsidies. Now, today we probably think of the post office as a fairly marginal institution. We think of Cliff Clavin. You think of like lunatics with guns. You think of all sorts of silly stuff. But the post office is one of the most extraordinary institutions in American history. It's written into the Constitution that Congress has to establish a post office. And one of the first great debates in Congress in 1792 was exactly what sort of post office will we have? And the post office is by far the largest body of government in the early republic. It was like the Pentagon and the Department of State and Pentagon all rolled into one. I mean, it was this huge, the largest federal body. And understand the post office at that time, it was what linked this whole country. It's what made this huge country one unit. I mean, you had to have a post office to link Massachusetts to Georgia, to Vermont, and to Pennsylvania. And also understand this, that guess what the primary thing that the post office handled? Newspapers. 70% of the traffic of the post office in the 1790s was newspapers. By the 1830s, it was over 90%. That's basically, the post office was basically the circulation manager for the newspaper system of the country. So the crucial issue that Congress faced in 1792 was, what are we going to charge newspapers to be mailed? Since all newspapers are distributed by the mails, it was a very important question. It was a huge expense for any publishers, what they had to pay for their mails. Now today, of course, listening to these sort of current blowhards talking about free markets and all this, we would expect that Thomas Jefferson and all these people would have stood up in the floor of the House and the Senate waving copies of Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations and saying, of course, he's got to pay full freight. No free lunch for these guys. Free market. If you can't cut it in the free market, you're history, pal. You're out of business. That's the way it is in America. That's what we would expect, right? It wasn't quite that way. In fact, this is how it went. There were basically two schools of thought when Congress was debating what to charge newspapers to be mailed in 1792. And this is the debate, by the way, that went on for the next 75 years. One extreme position was the position that all newspapers should be heavily subsidized. They should be charged a much smaller figure than the actual cost to encourage more newspapers to be distributed and printed, to encourage a print culture, to encourage a democratic society. That was one extreme position. At the other side of the spectrum, James Madison's position was that all newspapers at all times should always be mailed for free, no charge. Any charge whatsoever would be a form of censorship against dissonant ideas. Madison was emphatic about this, as were many other members. It was incumbent upon the government to encourage the widespread distribution and creation of diverse media, and that charging full freight would be a form of censorship that would be unacceptable in a free society. Now, Madison didn't win that fight. These guys over here won it, but it was still a heavy subsidy. And that was the range of debate for the next 75 years. And in fact, by 1850, they had free postage for publications within their county. I mean, they finally won that fight. But that gives you a sense of the commitment our founders had to humane, sensible policies to establish a viable free press. And it's worth noting it was the abolitionists who were the ones who led the fight for free postage. The feminists, the dissident groups that knew they couldn't cut it if they had to pay full freight, that they were the first groups that would be sliced out if they had to pay more for postage. Not the big guys, the little people, the dissident, the marginal groups, as Madison understood. When Tocqueville came to the United States in the 1830s and wrote his magisterial work, Democracy in America, there are passages in there where he goes on and on about being astounded at the array of print material in the United States and the degree of literacy in the United States. Nowhere else in the world had anything close to a number of newspapers or magazines or the high degree of literacy in the northern states. It was simply unprecedented anywhere in the world. Well, guess what? It had nothing to do with free markets. It was all the result of enlightened, brilliant policymaking and subsidies. That's what produced that print culture. And that's what a sane and rational society needs to do today. We need to think in terms of coming up with creative policies to spawn a diverse, rich, and viable media culture, as our founders did along those lines. The second myth that protects corporate media power and prevents informed public participation in media policymaking is the myth that professional standards in journalism will protect us. Thank God we have professional journalism. We don't have anything to worry about. They'll protect us from commercial pressures from owners and advertisers and protect the integrity of the news product. Oh, if that were only true. That would be nice. I mean, all these would be, if they were all true, this one is true, I'd love it. Regrettably, even at its best, professionalism and journalism has its limitations. It is a mixed blessing. I write about in the book, the new book, I write at length about the origins of professional journalism and some of the deep-seated problems in it. It emerged basically roughly 100 years ago as a result or as a response to the concentration that had taken place in newspaper markets. So you had single town newspapers or duopoly town newspapers, and it was impossible to start competitive newspapers. And in that environment, having stridently partisan newspapers where the views of the owners were always the views you saw throughout the paper was anathema. It was bad politics because it reeked of corruption if you had one newspaper in town and it was stridently partisan and no one else could start a newspaper. And that, you know, we'd had stridently partisan journalism in the first 100 years of this country's history, but it had been an environment where you had multiple newspapers, you could start newspapers, a competitive environment. That was fine then, but in a non-competitive environment, stridently partisan journalism simply was a fiasco. And professional journalism emerged as the solution to the problem for media owners, and it was publishers who really pushed professional journalism as much as anyone. And it was the revolutionary idea that you'd have owners and advertisers on one side and journalists on the other side, and you have a Chinese wall, as they call it, between them, the separation of church and state. And if you read a newspaper, you would know if the reporters, and you read any trained professional's newspaper, you would know if the owners were Republicans or Democrats or socialists, still hypothetical, vegetarians, because the trained reporters would be covering the news straight, professional, nonpartisan, you could trust them. There were problems built into the whole system all along. I can't go into many of them now, but the crucial one, and the one that's worth keeping in mind because it pertains to a lot of the issues today, is that professional journalism had built into it a strong belief that what drives stories are official sources. When people in power say something, you report it. When people in good journalism get someone from the other side of the aisle to comment on it, but it's driven by what people in power say. And the problem with that, of course, is that when people in power don't want to talk about something, it makes it very hard for journalists to raise that issue without being accused of being partisan and unprofessional, which is absolutely the worst thing a journalist can be accused of. But even with these problems for professional journalism, and there are many others, it looked good compared to what it replaced. It looked real good compared to the stridently partisan and corrupt journalism it replaced in the first half of the 20th century. But the problem we face is that it never got it in writing, that the power of journalists to control the news was something that was granted by owners and advertisers, and it's something that commercial interests have been reneging on for the past 30 years. We've seen a tremendous commercial attack on the integrity of journalism for the last 25 or 30 years. And increasingly, it's clear that doing good journalism is seen by the media owners as bad business. It costs a lot of money. It doesn't bring a lot of money back. We've seen a shriveling of resources going to things like investigative journalism. We've seen a shriveling of resources going to things like international coverage. The drop-off in our international coverage in the last 20 years is stunning, and it certainly contributes to the fact that the American people know almost nothing about the world. How ironic that the country that runs the world, that has, well, how many countries do we have military bases in? 50, 60, 70, I don't know. We have a population that can barely name more than three countries in the world. I mean, it's an extraordinary situation. It isn't helped by the fact that we have very few journalists covering the world for our media anymore, far fewer than we did 20 years ago or 30 years ago. In 1964, the cover of Time magazine had the French foreign minister on the cover and had a long interview with the French foreign minister about European politics. Unthinkable today. It was simply way beyond the range of thinkable thought that you would see something like that in our news media today. What we've seen is that instead of hard investigative news and hard political news, what we get is largely stenography to people in power. Get a quote from one politician, maybe if you're a good journalist, get a quote from the other side of the aisle. But you never go to check who's telling the truth. That makes you partisan suddenly, or you rarely do that. It's a scoundrel's paradise. Liars can just lie, and if they're challenged on it, they say, well, my opponent's partisan. How can you believe them? The great line of Fox News Channel, we report, you decide. An extraordinary comment that they would think that is what journalism is. We report, you decide. We repeat what people in power say, and good luck if it's the truth. It's up to you to figure it out. We're going to go back to sleep over here. The commercialization of news has been astonishing, too. The sort of increase of celebrity stories, stories that give the illusion of controversy, which people are interested in, but actually deal with trivial matters. We've seen almost the complete elimination of journalism on radio, or certainly it's near total elimination. And then, of course, we see the deterioration of journalism with local TV news. That's a punchline. Local TV news. This is interesting. This is where most Americans, according to surveys, get their news, local television news. It's really interesting. I find that interesting because from my experience, and I travel around the country a bit, talking to people, from my experience, you know, this is a country, I think we all know, that is increasingly a diverse country. Different languages, different cultures, different religions, different backgrounds. People listen to different types of music. We don't have a lot in common, less in common perhaps than we did in the past. And I think I found the one thing that unites all Americans, the one thing that holds us all together as a people, and that is that every American thinks their local TV news is the worst in the country. It's our defining, uniting feature today. And one measure also of the problem with journalism, the collapse of professionalism, is journalist morale. If you were to go into a bookstore 25 years ago, you'd see book after book of heroic war stories of journalists talking about how they slayed some government or some person in power broke a big story that led to some great change in policy that improved the human condition. Today, you go to look at the journalist rack at Borders or Barnes & Noble at some bookstore. It's book after book of journalists bemoaning the terrible situation of journalism today. Linda Foley, the president of the Newspaper Guild, which is the union of print journalists in the United States, tells me that the number one complaint of her members, way beyond salary, way beyond job benefits, by far, is commercial encroachment on journalism, how it's destroying the craft people got into journalism to do. By far the number one concern. A Harvard study that's been done by a psychologist of journalists over the last 10 years concluded that a majority of working journalists in the United States could be characterized as clinically depressed because they're so despondent about commercial pressures upon them at their work. A majority of working journalists can be characterized as clinically depressed. That's how severe this attack is. And that explains why in the fight for media policy, the fight for more diverse media ownership, the journalists union is the number one union that supports us, Linda Foley and the Newspaper Guild. Not only that, the other unions of all the media workers, Screen Actors Guild, AFTRA, Writers Guild, Directors Guild, they're right there too. The people who are on the front lines of the system understand how rotten it is at the core and how it has to change. That what they got into these fields to do, what they were driven to do, they cannot do in this system. So Judy's got a son who's an editor in Hollywood working on programs that Judy's embarrassed to watch because that's where the employment is. And so her son's union, to the extent he would have one, is leading the fight to create a media system where there's better programming, better opportunities for our wonderfully talented population to exercise what they wish to do. Well, the third great myth that protects corporate media power is by far the most prevalent. It's probably the one that has the most truth. It's certainly the most convincing. I suspect you've all heard it. This is the idea that no matter how lame the media system might seem, due to competitive pressures, even if it's not a purely competitive market, even if it's a semi-monopolistic market, competitive pressures, the pursuit of profit, forces companies to give the people what they want. You know, I think I was in my crib and my mother was leaning over and telling me the media system is giving you what you want, so shut up. I said, the idea is, if you don't like what the media system's producing, don't blame the media giants, blame the morons who are demanding it. The morons were demanding, you know, shows about ballet and giraffes, they'd be getting shows about ballet and giraffes. They're demanding shows like Get Me Off This Island, I'm a Celebrity, so they're getting shows like Get Me Off This Island, I'm a Celebrity. They're giving the people what they want. At a certain level, this is an argument, well, first of all, you understand, this argument has nothing to do with journalism. This is an argument that deals with entertainment media. To the extent that anyone even makes this argument with journalism, it automatically calls into question someone's vision of what journalism is. But for entertainment media, this is an argument that it's on the surface it seems self-evident. Of course, what TV network puts shows on that people aren't going to want to watch? Who would make a movie that people wouldn't want to go see? Of course that's true. It's got to be true. It makes perfect sense. You know, it's just hopeless. Morons want to watch crappy shows. They're going to produce crappy shows for morons. And life goes on. The great, you know, it's always funny how this works. Everyone thinks, well, of course, it's other people who are the morons. You know, it's like, well, not me. I like the good stuff, but I guess I'm going to have to watch the crappy show since all the morons are demanding. I guess I'll watch it tonight. But it's a deeply flawed argument. It takes a very complex relationship about supply and demand of media content and reduces it in a vulgar manner to a highly simplistic thing where people are born and at birth have a full slate of media preferences that they're born with before they've taken a breath of air. Then they come of age with this full slate. They start barking out commands to a handful of media giants. So like throwing fish out or, you know, to a starving animal. And the media giants comply and give you what you want. It doesn't really work that way at all. In fact, and this is something I go in detail in the book and I'm just going to talk about quickly here. The media companies don't give you what you want as much as they give you what you want within the range of what they can make the most money giving you. That's a very narrower range than what you might actually want. I'll give you one example. It goes back to one of the themes I talked about earlier. Surveys show, a survey done by the ad industry that I invoke in the new book, that 65% of Americans, roughly, think there's vastly too much advertising in the media today. 65% of Americans. Huh. Are you going to give you that one, you think? Don't hold your breath waiting for them to give you that one. But if 2% of Americans said, we want another show like Get Me Off This Island, I'm a Celebrity, you'd probably four of them on the air next year, because they can make a lot of money doing those shows cheaply and pummeling you with ads. They aren't going to give you a choice of programs without ads, because they can't make as much money on them. In fact, that's the limitation of the market. You can't use the market to express non-market preferences. It's a circular relationship. That's what it takes policy and civic activism to engage in that. And to give some sense of how supply, you know, it's not just that demand creates supply, supply creates demand. I'll give an example I've used before, but it's one that's still the best example because it's the clearest I know of how this process works. In the 1970s, in the United States, in the early to mid-1970s, approximately 10% of the films that were shown in movie theaters were foreign language films, 10% of the films. By the mid-1980s, it was down to like 3 or 4%, 5%. By the end of the 1990s, it was down under 1%. And except for the latest film in Aramaic, I think it'd be down to like 0.25%, Aramaic aside. Basically, they stopped existing in American theaters in the last 25 years. Now, by the give the people what they want hypothesis, what you would expect had taken place is that at some point in the last 20 years, the American people stood up en masse, slammed their fist on the table, and said, get those foreign films out of our theaters. We refuse to go to see them anymore. Clear them out of here. We're not going to go to any more foreign language films. We don't want those anymore. That's the explanation to give the people what you want theory would suggest. In fact, nothing of that kind took place. What happened was this. Starting in the mid-70s, there was a revolution in theatrical distribution of films. The single-screen theater was replaced by the multi-screen theater. And the companies that only had single-screen theaters could no longer compete. Because once a company's got 10 screens, there's one ticket taker for 10 screens, one popcorn baker for 10 screens, one projectionist for 10 screens. The person who's got one screen for all those labor simply can't compete. There is a very short period between the single screen theaters were almost all out of business. So this entire network of single screen theaters was wiped out, and that's what the whole foreign language film network had been. In New York City, for example, in 1975, there were 25 theaters that showed nothing but foreign language films. 25 in Manhattan, just in Manhattan. In Seattle, where I lived at the time, there were 6, 7, 8 theaters that showed nothing but foreign language movies in the mid-1970s, single-screen theaters. Today, there's hardly any left at all, if any. They're a very small number, if there are any at all. And what happened was that when a filmmaker came over in the late 70s and 80s to show their film from France or Norway or Japan, their theaters they went to were no longer in business. They couldn't survive. So they go to the big multiplex. The multiplex said, well, you can open up on all 80 of our mall units, but you've got to spend X dollars on your TV campaign to drum up an audience for the first weekend, or otherwise we can't justify letting you have one of our screens. We've got a Hollywood film that's lined up to be there. And some of them stayed, and it was a gradual process, but pretty much over time it weeded pretty much everyone out. And then what happened is by the 1990s, and certainly through today, most people had not developed a taste for these films. When I was in college, probably half the films I went to were foreign language films. It was standard. I actually knew directors and actors and actresses of French films and German films. And my friends said you could talk about them. By the 1990s, I remember talking to a student of mine in a class, and he goes, gee, when did they start making movies in France? So that student, when he goes to a video store, would probably whiz right by the foreign language section, not even pause, if there is even a foreign language section. And the point I'm making is supply creates demand as much as demands create supply. If you're not exposed to something, you can't develop a taste for it. It's a complex relationship. Insane media policy making, humane and rational media policy making allows for that. It allows for new things to come up that aren't going to automatically pass the test immediately. So it takes time to develop a taste for something. And it's important that we have that capacity in a good society. Also, there's something else we know clearly about media, that there's media markets not only don't always give us what we want, they clearly give us lots of stuff we don't want. And what economists call externalities, that have tremendous effects upon us, and they make a lot of money for the owners, but they're disastrous for society, and there are huge social costs that have to be paid by society. And one of those I spoke about already is the effects of hyper-commercialism to children. This makes a lot of money for these companies that do it, like Viacom, which owns Nickelodeon, makes a lot of money for these advertisers who benefit by it. But the social costs of what this is going to do to children in terms of obesity, in terms of attention deficit disorder, none of them are going to have to bear in the market. The market can't address that. That's a problem we as a society will have to address. We as a society will have to pay for. The people who benefit by it are just going to take the money and go off into the sunset. We're going to be left holding this bag for these costs. Economists call those externalities. And the only way you can deal with externalities is not through the market. The market fails, that's why you have the problem, but it's through enlightened public policymaking to limit them, the negative externalities, and to try to actually produce positive externalities. A media system that generates good things as a consequence, not bad things, as crazy as that might seem at times. And the last great myth that has to be dealt with is the idea that technology will set us free. Okay, we got a lousy media system, there's too much commercialism, there's too much concentration, but heck, not to worry, the internet's here and the internet will set us free. All we have to do is go on and start our web blog and our website and interact with each other and we can rock on and everyone will live happily ever after. We don't have to get any muddy fights with media companies. You might detect that I'm not really impressed with that argument. Having said that, I want to point out that the new technologies have been extraordinary, truly extraordinary. And I use them all the time. I suspect a lot of you are like me. I wake up in the morning, I turn my computer on. Before I go to bed, it's the last thing I do is turn it off. I've got it on all day. I use the internet extensively for my research, for social reasons, for everything. It's a key part of my life. Having access to international news, global information has been amazing. Email, all those things. But that does not mean it absolves our problems, that it resolves them, that we should be satisfied with it. The internet, for example, has been around for the commercialized World Wide Web for some 12 years now. And in 12 years now, people could start websites. But how much legitimate commercial competition has it introduced to the existing media giants? How much? Virtually none. Being able to start a website does not mean you can do a viable commercial media content site. The market is still a very ruthless commissar when it comes to media content. And the market is not very accommodating to successful internet content sites. The internet itself, too, is not some magical technology that flew out of the sky and landed like in Wyoming in 1978. The internet is a direct result of explicit policies. In fact, you could argue that the internet's a testament to socialism. It was an enormous public subsidy for decades that no private concern would have ever done because there's no way to make money off it. In the 70s, the government went to AT&T and said, hey, will you guys take this thing over for us? AT&T studied it and said, hey, I can't make any money on this, pal, you keep it. It's a clunker. I'm sure they regret that now. But the point is, it was a testament to public sector spending and vision that created it. And then the fact that it spread so quickly was a testament to the common carrier provision of our telecommunications law, a statute which required people who carried the internet to make it open to anyone. They couldn't discriminate against any users. That was crucial to its rapid spread and diffusion. Policies in both points, subsidies. And the future of the internet, how it develops, will be entirely determined by policies. To give you one example, right now most Americans get their internet, if they get broadband, or even not broadband, they're getting it either through a phone line or cable line. Some Americans might get it through an electrical wire, electricity wire. But they're paying a lot of money for broadband. We have the technological capacity that we're developing right now. In fact, Urbana, where I live, is one of the test markets. Test communities is a better term, because it's a non-commercial thing. To have a wireless broadband internet access radically superior to any of the wire services, where the uplink is as fast as the downlink, and the downlink is much faster than the best cable modem or DSL line available now. We have the capacity that's entirely wireless. We have the capacity as a society to make this so our entire country has this. So no one will ever have to pay a cable company or phone company to get anywhere you go in the country. You could have this, just turn on your computer and have that instantly, wireless internet access. We can do that as a society. We have the capacity to do that. And the cost would be 50 cents, a dollar a person. Extraordinarily low. It's a natural monopoly. It's a classic case that we could do that. It would end the digital divide immediately. Instantly, we could do that as a society. It's a policy decision. It requires a certain amount of spectrum. There'd be a continuous amount of spectrum that can be used for the technology, that would be open for public use for this internet, but we could do it. But there's one big barrier to it. Hyman Roth and Michael Corleone, the cable companies and the phone companies, they've got a cash cow there that's billions of dollars. They're going to do everything in their power to keep it a private system where you won't have that, where everyone's going to have to pay a lot more for a lousier service. And if they can prevent us a policy fight, we won't have that. But if we win that policy fight, we can have a much better system in the public interest, but that's a policy fight. And that will do a long way towards determining the caliber of internet and digital communication system we're going to have in our lifetimes, and a long way towards determining the sort of society we have. Copyright, too, is another issue. On and on, there are policy-making issues that will affect the internet, and they're in our hands, what we do with them, how we organize. As I said, you're probably wondering, well, where's the good news part of this talk, right? Yeah, there is good news. A year and a half ago, it did seem hopeless. When the FCC announced it was going to review all its media ownership rules in the fall of 2002 about how many TV stations a single company could own nationally or locally, or whether media could have what's called cross-ownership. And this would basically mean one company could own the newspaper, three TV stations, eight radio stations, the cable system, and the billboard monopoly in one town, have company towns for media if they got rid of the cross-ownership provision, which is what the big media companies desperately want. When this came up for review at the FCC, I wrote a piece in The Nation with my friend John Nichols. We said it was hopeless. The majority of the FCC is in the bag for industry. The Republican Party's in the bag. The leadership, at least, is in the bag for industry. They will get no press coverage. We don't have a prayer. And then something extraordinary happened that no one anticipated. We made history. A number of us who worked on this issue, and there are lots of groups that were involved, and we really raised hell like no one thought possible. Between 2 and 3 million people contacted the FCC and Congress in the course of 2003, protesting media concentration and demanding that these rules not only be kept, but be tightened so we have more diverse ownership, more local ownership, less concentrated corporate ownership. It was an outburst that came from across the political spectrum. Among the groups working on it were not only Common Cause, MoveOn.org, my group, Free Press, Consumers Union, but the National Rifle Association. Brent Bozell is one of the leading critics of liberal media. His Parents Television Council was one of our strongest allies. People have said local media is important in this country. If we get rid of these media ownership rules, it will be the end of local media, which it will be in this country. And one doesn't have to be a liberal to believe that. One just has to believe in a free press to believe that, because you can't have a free press in a country like this if you don't have local media. It's simple. You've got to have media that represents communities, that covers communities. So it was an extraordinary development. Members of Congress, in 2003, in January, I was at Washington for a hearing on radio ownership, the Senate Commerce Committee, and there was a Senator, John Ensign, from Nevada, who's on that committee, a Republican. And again, if you've seen the film The Godfather 2, there's a senator from Nevada in that film. Remember him? This guy's a dead ringer for that guy. And I think he's cut from the same ethical cloth, because he's completely in the bag of the NAB, National Association of Broadcasters. And Senator Ensign stood up at this hearing in January 2003. He said, I want you to know that in all my time in the Senate, I've never had any constituent care about media policy. This issue has not registered with anyone. It is completely unimportant. I don't think we have to pay any attention to this. And I don't think any of my colleagues have either. And, you know, I think he's probably telling the truth. I think he probably had never had a constituent tell him that. And I think most of his colleagues hadn't either. But I can tell you this, by the end of 2003, there wasn't a single member of Congress who hadn't been contacted by at least 100 of their constituents on this issue. John McCain said this was the it was universally regarded. The number two issue in all of Congress last year was media ownership. Only the war in Iraq exceeded it in constituent interest. I mean, this is an issue that had never even been on the map before. And as John McCain said, it was the only issue that became a big issue that wasn't driven by some sort of corporate PR lobby that was pushing it. It was actually a legitimate grassroots public interest movement, not driven by some private commercial concern trying to rake in a lot of money. And, you know, right now, the FCC, as you probably know, some of you voted in June of last year to relax these rules dramatically, but we were able to get it overturned in the U.S. Senate with a 55-40 vote in September. We're still hoping to get it up for a vote in the House. Don't hold your breath. The way the House rules are written, the leadership can basically prevent a vote except under the most extreme circumstances. And the leadership of the House, under direct orders from the White House, is not going to let this come to a vote, because the last thing President Bush wants to have to do is veto this bill, which is a bill which Rupert Murdoch desperately wants, who can buy more media, in an election year, because this is so unpopular with the American people. Surveys show that the more people know about this issue, the more they oppose relaxing media ownership rules. There's a direct relationship. The less someone knows, or if they know nothing, they might support it. It's an iron relationship. But it's up in the air. The courts are presently hearing a case to throw out what the SEC has done in Philadelphia. We'll hear about it in a month or two. But I'm very optimistic we're going to win this one. And I will say this, that if we have a change in administration, we will definitely win it. This policy will not be changed if there's a different resident at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue next year. It will die instantly. But the point to understand, though, is this is just the tip of the iceberg. What drove this movement last year, what drove 2 or 3 million people to come out, what drove in one afternoon, we had 40,000 people telephone members of the House in one afternoon last summer. What drove this was not a conviction that our media system is good and we don't want it to get bad. It was a conviction that our media system is terrible and we don't want it to get worse. The problem isn't that we want to protect the status quo, we want to change the status quo. This movement was driven by strong conviction that we need radical transformation in media policymaking, radical improvement in the quality of our media system. And I think we're seeing a burgeoning movement go on all over the country. I see it firsthand because the group I helped form, Free Press, but here in Chicago, for example, we have several people at the talk tonight from a group called Chicago Media Action who are organizing at the local level, because there are a number of local issues that you can fight on. The quality of your local public television system, whether you're going to have billboards. Billboards are a monopoly service. They're granted by municipalities. There's no, like, God-given right to put a billboard up and gross people out. If you go to the state of Vermont, you won't see a single billboard, because the people of Vermont said, we don't want billboards in this state. And God, is it nice to drive in Vermont and not see a billboard and see those beautiful mountains. You know, we can have that. It's a matter of organizing for that. If you go to Baltimore, you won't see any billboards for malt liquor in working class and residential neighborhoods, because the people of Baltimore organized, said, we're not going to have liquor ads in working class and residential neighborhoods. These are issues we can win. And I think what's exciting about media, for a long time people thought it was a hopeless issue. Now it looks like actually one of the easiest issues to win on, because you can organize across the political spectrum and you can win tangible victories. Once you win a small victory, you can keep it. They can't take it away. The comparison would be to campaign finance reform. The painful truth we've all discovered is that unless you have completely public financing for elections, what happens is no matter what reform you have, as we've discovered this year, if you leave even the slightest crack, big money will blow that open and destroy the spirit of the enterprise, which is why most campaign finance reform activists have more or less given up. Media reform, you can win a tangible victory and keep it. One of the victories we're going to probably win as a result of what we did in the last year is we're going to force the government to establish 500 to 1,000 new channels for low-power radio in this country, non-commercial, non-profit, community-run, low-power radio stations. So a city like Chicago might get 4 or 5 new stations. They won't have any ads in them. They'll be low-powered. They'll serve the city of Chicago. run by nonprofit community groups, and there are different groups taking turns having it. But new voices on the air, and that'll be because we forced them to do it, because they know they've got to pay attention to us. I guess I'll close with two quotes. First one is, the politics involved here, like all politics, go back to what Saul Alinsky said. To defeat organized money, you need organized people. It's the only way. It's really politics 101. It's always true. It's the foundation of all political activism. To defeat organized money, you need organized people. And what we've learned in media is we can organize people here. And when we do organize, we can win. And it's very exciting. The arguments I just talked about, the defense of our corrupt media system, collapse when people talk about them and study them. They only hold up when they're unexamined. And the last quote I'll give is the one I think is the most important. This comes from Noam Chomsky, the noted linguist. Chomsky likes to say, and I think it's really a great moral statement, if you act like there's no hope for change for the better, you guarantee there will be no change for the better. It's really your choice. It's all our choices that we have to make. Thank you. Thank you.